This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program, as is often the case, features two poets. First, Sonoma County poet Kathleen Winter, winner of the Elixir Press Poetry Award, reads from her first full-length collection, Nostalgia for the Criminal Past. Norman Duby says, Kathleen Winter's first collection of poems is formally brilliant, life-hurdling, and volunteers language with a quick edge that advances ideas almost with abandon. This is the kind of work William Hazlitt would have reserved the word gusto for. It is all a great pleasure. And then poet and writer F.D. Reeve. This segment of the program first aired back in 2008. He talks with me about his friendship with Robert Frost, his son, the late actor Christopher Reeve, and reads from what was then his latest collection of poetry, The Toy Soldier. You'll also hear some of Reeve's poetry from The Blue Cat Walks the Earth, read to jazz accompaniment. But first, here is Kathleen Winter.
I want to start with the title poem of the book, which is a prose poem, and it was inspired by a friend of mine's going up to a big farm in Humboldt County. He had sold his straw bale house to the farmers, and he went up to the farm to help them put it back together again. When he came back from that trip, he told me about it, and this was my romanticized version of life on this farm. Nostalgia for the criminal past. Those days we never saved. We never went to a bank except to rob it. The getaway car had no parts to control smoke, our escape route lost in a plume of poisons. We hid on a hill where nobody went. It shot straight up. Even animals were winded when they got to the top. Raccoons, red foxes passing out on the gingerbread porch. We let our hair grow wild. We never paid taxes. There's nothing that wouldn't grow there. Soil seething with worms, fog slithering over the oaks, sun going and coming erratically, an occasional god. It was warm sometimes. Dogs snoring on the beds, on the green couch stuffed with surfaces of birds. Like the children, we were naked. It gave us time to read. Not having to dress, to do laundry, we built silos of time in which to drown. The book has two nostalgia poems, and so I'll read the second one as well. This poem was inspired by growing up in Texas and hearing a lot about the Apollo space program, having some cousins who lived close to NASA who were fond of going there, and then seeing Ron Howard's wonderful documentary about the Apollo program. And this poem, Nostalgia for Apollo. Back then, back there, the handsome astronauts could build their own machines. Each man assigned a wing, a plan, a system to design. In their white shirts, in their thin ties, they worked it out. At cocktail parties, on cocktail napkins at the bar, they synchronized the rendezvous of Mastership with its squat module. Or, alone in their well-ordered minds, they engineered the right thing for a man to say when stepping off the last rung onto lunar dust, just after taking a piss on the ladder. I miss their gravity-free cantering across the fields of the moon, their silent, patient waving from behind curved glass, their close-cropped hair, their mission control cigars, their guts. I miss their elevated heart rates at the takeoff, godlike, their views of Earth's swirled atmosphere, their cowboy tendency to terseness, their ticker tape parades, their quaint faith in our nation, their quaint male universe, in which I was a lovely and a silent child. In addition to the more logical poems of the book, some of the poems are just based more on sound quality than on the argument or the idea of the poem. And so I want to read one of those. It's called Homage to Homage. Penumbra's a conundrum. Conundrum is penumbra. An umbrella's humdrum, an elision. Humdrum as a striking out, elision. There is no dearth of little forks. To fashion a remedy of friction, Townsend's big-eared bat and pallid bat and pallid bat an ashen bat. A mighty swat, a bulk, a leaking out about a tank. O big-eared bat, a drumming strike, a remedy of little dearth. There is no humdrum remedy, pallid as and is. Penumbra is a leaking out, a light wave, umbrellaed about. Of homage to elision, there's no dearth. Conundrum is a little balk. That's a poem also for baseball lovers, with a lot of baseball terminology thrown in there. So this poem that I'll read next is a persona poem, which is a poem that's emphatically spoken by a character who isn't the writer. And I think of all my poems really as being fiction, not being straightforward autobiographical work, but this is just even more so in that it's a completely made-up character that really doesn't have a lot to do with me. It's called Jellyfish Elvis. When my aunt by marriage, Aunt Noreen, was in the beach movie with Elvis, and she said his toenails were too long, I used to think it all was her. He couldn't be the slob she took him for. That all that crap about his breath being a bomb, his table manners like an army mess, his undershirts rust-stained, and even his eyebrows permanently out of whack was just a bunch of sour grapes that she cooked up to balance for the fact that she was cut out of the picture after it had wrapped, in spite of how it hardly was her fault about the man-o-war that stung her shin during the kissing scene with Elvis and a couple other girls, when he was grabbing her around her waist and had his tongue, she swears, half down her throat, when, like a fireball or a billion ant bites, all at once, the tentacle associated with her leg. And naturally, without a chance to think about it, even to cry out, she bit him hard. But other stuff's come out about him, pills and funny sandwiches. And dry old bird she is, Noreen still has the scar. So this next poem is inspired by The Onion, that humorous website and publication and calendar that's been going on for a while. And it has a special five-star word in it, Schadenfreude, imported from the German. And that word means to take pleasure in someone else's misery. So when you hear that, that's the definition. Hamster thrown from monster truck. This is the headline from The Onion, we love best. What does this say about us? At least our Schadenfreude is minimalist? Neither of us ever had a hamster for a pet, or even knew one as a friend's pet or the teacher's pet. A hamster for the masses of a third grade class, for instance. Nor do we know anything of gerbils. Not on their own account, neither their relationship to hamsters. But monster trucks, these we've seen. Monsters of all models, guzzlers on the byways of our humble town, rumbling above us at the stoplight like a frisky two-story building, charging forward at the change on supersized tires, swinging, sometimes from the bumper, a pair of balls. The hamster's monster truck has thrown him for a loop. We think it probably shook him up. He took the last lap of the treadmill track too fast. Fans in the bleachers standing on their seats, the sun a beer haze through their shades. We hope the hamster's landed on his feet. The first section of the book is organized around a lot of different animal motifs and gets a little darker and more serious toward the end. So I'll read some of those poems from the last part of that section as well. And this one is called Country Club, 4th of July. Mother is out of breath with it, the studded gladiator sandal. The newsprint ad for it, which thrills her cloistered heart and strains the worked-up muscles of her chest. American crawl, propel me, small and hungry, gripping a plastic bag, toward the bounty of illusion water magnifies. Thousands of goldfish and coins tossed in the luminous chemical pool. And the last poem of that section is called Eschatology. Eschatology, a word that relates to burial, death, last rites. And the poem has a quotation at the beginning, an epigraph from the economist John Maynard Keynes, who said, "In the long run, we are all dead." Eschatology. Gray pelt of mouse, limp in injury, beneath the kitchen's leaking ceiling. Gray subtraction. I crouch in a cramped room, displacing my mind, trying to put it, for an instant, into your body. The bait was irony working again. You can taste the bitter end. Perhaps you somehow know there's nothing to be afraid of. The irony of nothing, taking so much of our attention. Power of the vacuum, ripping us again and again out of our upholstered moment. So I'll go on now to some of the poems in the second section of the book, which are inspired by place, by either an environment or a landscape. And the first one I'll read is called Postcard 1923, Detail of a Laundress. And it was inspired, indeed, by an old postcard. And the first line of the poem was written on the postcard. Grace Finney can't live through the night. As ever, mother, she imagines herself free, dropping heavy as her black iron through sheets of altostratus, through linen shirts and lace blouses, smashing like a barrel through Niagara's filigree, where Annie Edson Taylor said she'd never do that again, plunging from earth faster than blind Sonora Carver, diving a roan from the top of the 60-foot tower into a metal pool. The weight of faith hastens her from blue starch, backache, burns and cabbage, from radishes and fennel grown wild by the roadside, away from cider and weak tea. Aggressive descender, she swoops through the hours. The ballast of a tumor hurries her toward God. That poem has a couple of interesting historical figures, two women that I refer to: Annie Edson Taylor, who was the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel and survive to tell about it, a 60-year-old retired schoolteacher who needed money and did this as her plan to support herself, because she anticipated then going on a lecture series afterward. Blind Sonora Carver dove on the top of a horse many times off of diving boards into a pool 60 feet below, and two interesting women from our American past. The next poem is called Cape Architecture, and I was thinking of Cape Cod, but I think that there are a lot of eastern seaboard towns that this could refer to, Cape Architecture. The bled white morning light of being in small towns with nothing to connect you to them. No dog in the alley, no face or street corner, drugstore or barber. Cold October light, pinioning facades of antique New England. Stopping time, if it were not for the wind coming out of the oil paint. If it were not for a newspaper striking the sidewalk, and ice cream vendors uneasy tinkling. All we marry, all we bear, simply to avoid these frames. This is a poem that's set in Sonoma County. It's called Gray Muzzle. You signal from solitude. Fretful, slotted days you try to translate with mere words. San Francisco's crusted barnacles gorgeously pale across the bay. This bus rattles to it. Miles east, a filament of bridge slings curves above the roadbed, spine. Again, I read myself vertiginous when I should watch land move swiftly backwards, more lush, more various than language. Lean, contagious lover, in that tunnel I found the clean jewels of light. I left a sign for you before I packed and disappeared. Hurled rock at a fir near the waterfall, marked hard wet bark with a cluster of red dust. Winter rained down the tight channel around boulders grown in the stream, but the dog could not hold still for us or be black, as I'll search to remember. And the next poem, set in a different landscape in Tempe, Arizona, which is bounded on one side by Glendale and to the north by Scottsdale. So there's a reference in there to Scottsdale too. Orienteering. Fever tries to sweat me out of bed. Good my astragalus, commend me to your attentions. If my master could see the monster my dreams made me into. The minute I get to Paris, I said, I want to buy shoes. God, the dear old words, your name in vain lingering on my tongue or stuck half down the throat, a chicken bone, size of a crutch. In this peak, I'll talk with my teacher through the ether, through a threadbare hood. Streets midnighted by surviving trees, pecan, mock orange, it neighbors in different atmosphere of the tinseled city north, reclining at the river's hinge. Without children or religion, where am I now but on a mattress, cold flat on the floor, the bed I keep remaking? And another Sonoma County poem, this one written on Coleman Valley Road, one of the most beautiful West County roads, I think, and written there on a February afternoon, and hence titled Edge of February. Out past the animals, this afternoon's austere Pacific has never needed us. Winter thick heifers, lambs with schoolgirl shins in black knee socks. What do they care if Egypt's freed of oligarchy? Today, with plenty of sleep and strong coffee, I'm making a miniature, flexible heaven within my ribs. It includes each one of them. But if some end up in my stomach later, it won't surprise my friends. My lover is elsewhere. Down the steep hill in the ocean, I find his gray-blue hair. I see in him this Cooper's hawk that has no patience with my scrutiny. Between the truck and the bird's fence post winds a solid line, thin county road, impermeable asphalt between fields the hawk appears to squint at, looking past me to sheep and the ocean's organless surface, stainless in the distance. Joy is brief. It turns away, extends its limbs. Feathered, reptilian. And I think I will close with a few poems from the last section of the book. And the first of those, Wrong Sonnet, Multiplicity. My husband asks, why don't you write a poem about why you like Virginia Woolf when nobody else does? The excruciating detail of a marriage is what I like, I say. The drifting in and out of Clarissa's mind and into Peter's. How they notice the flow of London traffic as a living animal. How they feel themselves distributed in subatomic bits into each other and over the city's squares and towers, out into the hedgerows, the waves. But Clarissa wasn't married to Peter, he would say, if he'd read it. She was married to Richard. And I'd say, maybe she was. Maybe she was. And then the last poem of the book, which is one of the less logical poems, but nonetheless, I guess one of my favorites. Third Eye. I say, part of the eye has seen loss, part waits for it. Yet two horses, mild as mild dogs, came into the house. You say, we could agree to love them, while you read a book of accidental humor. In an etching, cylindrical engines blow the man overboard, back onto the ship. Aloft on fonts of water, frothing comic as sea monsters to science. You tell me, science, the mouse in my stomach is doubt. is the animal fear, wriggling. Yet sleeping naked, I go closer to beloved you, naked in a distant state. As Buddha on the bathroom counter holds something gold, maybe a lotus or a flame, between planes of his soul's Limoges. A gray horse settles down on kitchen floor before we touch her. Gladness fills the room, sunning the waiting, cracking it open. On the prow, a shark's jaw painted open. Oh, golden. Oh, gold.
This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to Sonoma County poet Kathleen Winter reading from her first full-length collection, Nostalgia for the Criminal Past. Now this. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest tonight is F.D. Reeve. He's the author of 9 books of poetry, including The Blue Cat, The Return of the Blue Cat, The Blue Cat Walks the Earth, and his latest collection, The Toy Soldier. I've also been enjoying a CD of Reeve reading his poems from The Blue Cat Walks the Earth, along with some pretty terrific jazz accompaniment. Reeve has published 7 books of fiction, as well as essays, reviews, etc., and he wrote the preface for the anthology For New Orleans and Other Poems. F.D. Reeve, welcome.
Hi, Catherine. It's very pleasant to be here. It's a lovely evening in California,
yeah.
And it's a very nice presence to be together and discussing poetry.
Well, thanks for coming all the way to Santa Rosa. We really appreciate it. Before we get to your poetry, which we will soon, it's not every day I sit with someone who was a friend of Robert Frost. You traveled to the Soviet Union with him as his personal translator and wrote a book about that experience, didn't you?
It's wonderful. That comes out as a conclusion, but it was nice. We agreed at the time that we weren't ever going to write. I agreed with, first it was Mr. Frost when I first met him, but after a one-night flight across the Atlantic, it was Franklin and Robert. And we agreed that we weren't going to write anything about it. But then his unexpected or his sudden death and unexpected death in the January after the trip persuaded Kathleen Morrison, his secretary, Kay Morrison, to get me to write the book. So that's mm-hmm. why I wrote it.
So is that how your friendship started, was this trip to the Soviet Union?
Right. But the interesting part is that I didn't want to go at all. I said, no, that I'm not going to go because I don't want to be a tour guide if that's all he's going to do. And so I had been in Russia the year before.
Uh-huh.
I had spent my chance to get there on an exchange with the academy. So I'd been there for a year. And I said, no, the only point in my going is to do something good for Mr. Frost, which would be to get him to meet some of the literary people that I had met in the previous year.
Uh-huh.
And after he agreed to that, I said, okay.
Great.
So he sort of got pushed around just a little bit more than he had first thought he would. And he took to it very nicely.
Good,
because, of course,
good.
He wanted to go and see Mr. K. That was the whole point. That was his idea.
Well, there was a newspaper article from Middlebury, Vermont on, what is the date? June 2nd. I'm going to read the first 2 sentences of this article. It has to do with how Robert Frost's home was vandalized recently.
Right.
And this is what the article says. Call it poetic justice. More than 24 young people who broke into Robert Frost's former home for a beer party and trashed the place are being required to take classes in his poetry as part of their punishment. Using The Road Not Taken and another poem as jumping off points, Frost biographer Jay Perini hopes to show the vandals the error of their ways and the redemptive power of poetry. Poetry is punishment. What do you think of this?
Yeah. Well, apparently the prosecutor called up Jay and asked him if he would do it, and Jay agreed. Poetry is punishment. God knows how much good it will do. I don't think Frost would have agreed to it at all. He'd have said,
right.
You know, spank the scoundrels and let's go on.
Right. I almost died when I read that myself.
Exactly.
Oh.
Well, you include a number of poems translated from Russian in The Toy Soldier. And how is it that you're fluent in Russian? And would you say something to me in Russian?
Могу. Дело в том, что я просто хотел сказать, что я, как сказать, я влюбился в язык. И просто этот язык мне просто очаровал с самого начала. И я вот просто следил.
And what does that mean?
That I was...
or do I want to know?
Yes, I was captivated by the language and the possibility of it. My first acquaintance with things really seriously Russian was an interpretation and understanding of the Russian novels, the big novels, by Blackmer, R.P. Blackmer, in college. I didn't know any Russian then at all, but I followed the care and the affection with which he approached and discussed and understood and explained and elucidated the works. And that took me into another world. So I actually then I learned the language.
Yeah, very good. Not an easy language to learn, I'm sure.
I think it's easier probably than Chinese and Japanese, which I don't know at all. So I think there are harder things.
A different key. Music in a different key, yeah. Well, let's turn to your latest collection of poems, The Toy Soldier. It is a very interesting book of poems, really, really beautiful. And it opens up with a lovely example of Ekphrasis, a stunning poem called Fra Angelico's Annunciation. Would you read that poem?
Can I just say a couple of words first?
Absolutely.
Imagine yourself in Florence. You're going to the monastery, San Marco Monastery, where Angelico was one of the brothers. You go into the ground floor, you go around and you go up the stairs to what would be the first floor, or what we would think of as the second floor in American terms. And as you walk up the stairs, the painting is right in front of you. So it reveals itself to you the way if you bicycle to Chartres, for example, from the north, the cathedral rises above the ground as you slowly approach the city. And the same thing happens with this painting. There's also a little reference. There's an epigraph, Ars ex arte orator, or art proceeds from art, which is attributed to Cimabue, who was a painter before, the century before Fra Angelico. And it's interesting because it emphasizes, despite the importance and the reliance of the painting on faith or on what you might call some kind of a philosophical reading, it's saying that art actually is the cause of art. Fra Angelico's Annunciation. In Florence, Cimabue was the first to paint words in gilt on his sacred illustrations of imaginary events and metaphoric lust. The Republic itself was young. There were no nations. People defined themselves by dialect and place. Local languages were thought adequate for local sensation. Suddenly, at the top of the stairs, two figures of the High Renaissance, he kneeling, pushing the air as if it were information, she seated, incredulous, as if already bearing a sacrifice. Neither moves. For a moment, the passion terrifies. Then life, like the dulcet Ave Maria, now invisible on the gold air, resumes its small town provocations. Each holds the other in the old belief. A warm light spreads over the fields of uneasy fantasies. When she completes her part, she too will be released. Nothing heard, nothing to hear. Deafness shines in their faces. His young body carries the news of divine love's elegance, and her beautiful figure heralds 1,000 years of grace.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In this book, there are some really deeply moving poems where a father figure appears. There are the Russian translations. There are all kinds of poems. How did you decide on the structure for this book?
Books are, unless you write a long poem, as you know, which is sort of one whole composite, even if it has smaller pieces in it, it's one general idea, it's one basic structure. Say a poem of, say, 20 or 30 or 40 pages. Your poems are written sort of piece by piece. And suddenly after 2 or 3 or 4 years or whatever, you say, wait a minute, that's enough poems to make a kind of statement. And I was pleased by this collection because of the variety that I was able to introduce into it. Because it seems to me that one of the things that often happens to people is they keep writing sort of in the same groove on the same record.
Yes.
And yes. I think just as a very wonderful Russian novel, say, has all kinds of colors and characters in it. So a book of poems that has a real variety.
Yeah. We get to feel all kinds of things in this book.
It will mean more.
Yes.
Right. So there is a group of poems. Uh-huh. There's some poems about the war. There's some about translations. There's some about things in general. But there's this mention that you, about so-called My Father, is a group of a dozen poems, which, like anything else, is partly true and full of falsehoods, full of all kind of imaginings. Nobody ever tells the truth. Poets never tell the truth, do we really?
No. What is the truth?
Exactly.
But that's another hour-long show.
Well, as Melville said, if you want the truth, you go to the soup societies.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to my conversation from 2008 with poet and writer F.D. Reeve.
Well, there's a section in the book called The Blue Boat on the St. Anne.
Yes.
And I was hoping you'd read the first two poems from that section, The Blue Boat on the St. Anne and The Lover.
Glad to. They're about my father as I can reimagine or reconstruct or reconstrue or rebuild or refancy my father. The Blue Boat on the St. Anne is actually the title of a watercolor that he gave me. I guess it's actually his widow gave me, who is now his widow, gave it to me. I picked it up at the time he was dying. He died about 20 years ago. But it is a painting of a tall man out in a blue canoe with a guide, salmon fishing, on the river called the St. Anne. So I have used that as a reconstruction of him.
Wonderful.
And there's only one thing in it that may be a little problem to a listener, and that is where it talks about nuns and cans. They're the markers for courses for boats on the water.
Oh. Okay.
On the rivers or on the seas or something like that. So the nun is a red and the can used to be black, it's now green. But it sort of marks the channels.
The nun has changed her habit.
Very much so, right? So no wimples. The Blue Boat on the St. Anne. I painted my father in as pilot of my model plane. One day it stalled at the top of an Immelmann, then plunged like a kingfisher into Silver Lake. I picked the pieces up by boat, a flawed design, a deceptive wind. My desire seemed the worst mistake. His death in plastic lasted years while I grew older in a dream world where he was hero. I longed to have his medals, his women, and his smile. Hot, inconsolable nights, I dived head over heels into the past to be steered by his hands and to take on his style. Divorced, remarried. Like leaves, the words floated downstream in the dark. He in a new life was rich and loved. My God drowned in the summer twilight. Falling asleep miles away, I remembered his hat above the horizon, making the bats curve in the sky. Life, once as bright as the sun-filled meadow scented with chamomile we used to cross to get to where the good fishing was, became unbridgeable winter days. He didn't care who I was, and I retaliated. We were dead on each other. Memory began to flatten his face. One autumn I recalled his mortality, sent him a letter. He sent me the watercolor of a boat like one that for 40 years he had fished for salmon from, sturdy enough for two heavy men, their rods and gear, as far into the north woods as they wished. Because the soul after death departs its suffering, like lightning arcing across the sky from nothing to nothing along the channels of electromagnetic nuns and cans. His spirit wearing his hat lights up what's left of our small future together, fishing from the blue boat on the St. Anne. The Lover. Women called him romantic, my old man. Five lady-killing fingers on each hand, lips thin but sweet like honey. Enchanting eyes that swiftly crowned each surmise with pleasure. Do you miss him, fair ladies? The last one, who alone held his heart and memorized his hands, he's her man forever. Spring now. The Shadbury's out. The river recedes. but nothing of his fine body remains, as if by invisible mending he wove himself into love.
Your poems, if not in actual form, often at least appear to be. Do you make up forms, and is this to help you move forward in writing the poem, or is it purely for aesthetic reasons?
There are a number of things. First of all, I feel very important that good poetry, poetry we really care about, has an underlying rhythm, which you can perceive, which you feel, which simply is there, the way good jazz has rhythm. It really good stuff, look at it wherever it is, there's a basic rhythm. And very often it can't be enhanced by rhyme, which many people try, simply because English has become very parsimonious. It's really outworn. English rhyme is worn out. It was wonderful 400, 300, 200 years ago, but it's very, very difficult to do. And rhyme tends to make something light or irrelevant or fun or jokey or something. So it's fine, wonderful rhyme. Once in a while, you can get a poem that is perfectly and fully rhymed, but not usually. So I've tried to go around it, tried to find different ways, half rhymes, slant rhymes. And one of the ways, for example, a number of things I've done and it seems successful is to use the same word as end word, line, ends of lines in different successive stanzas. So you get a three stanza poem, say, of eight lines each, and each line ends in the same word, which finally you sort of unconsciously keep hearing the words again, and it has the function of rhyme.
Absolutely. Interesting. Well, before we move on, how about two more poems from the section, The Blue Boat on St. Anne, the title poem of the book, The Toy Soldier, and then Fieldstones.
Okay. I don't know where The Toy Soldier came from. It was just an idea. It began, I can remember it beginning as a poem with the final image, the closing image. And the poem was actually written to the last line. That doesn't often, as you know, that doesn't often happen. You have to be sort of lucky to have that happen. And it did. And that's how, and of course, dealing with the father, the Hamlet reference comes crashing smooth, right? The Toy Soldier. Abstract, half false, to be or not to be. My life gains stature as my father dies. First sinking like the heavy moon each morning, then like starry Orion, climbing the sky with golden eyelids, my tunic turned to diamonds, my steel sword stiffening my thigh. Death is no model. Father and anti-father annihilate each other in summer air. Selves and anti-selves that no one thought of burn up like meteor showers. Everywhere time skips out of measure, hardly noticed, and space is neither here nor there. Turned out in the heavens like a sheep to pasture, I'll make my place the center by making maps. So what if the sun burns up? I'll hear antimatter collide with matter, smell the lightning and the thunder clap. The universe is paper, and I'll stand on it like a toy soldier on the Russian steppe. And very different in tone is the next one. Here we are in California, but imagine you're back in a rocky Vermont pasture.
I can do that.
Okay, there we are. Fieldstones. Two boulders on the hill lie scorched by the sun. Markers, my neighbor calls them, who follows the cow path into the woods above the pasture, looking for the Indian burying ground, not asking how they got there. Long after the glacier melted and the lake dried, field flowers ring them like medieval tombs, as if my father's granite body were Duke of the Air, with his blonde duchess embossed on the grass. All winter snow covers their faces. In spring, the runoff trickles behind their ears while the sap rises, the little leaves start, orioles sing in the orchard, and their children make love between their bones.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest tonight is F.D. Reeve, who is reading from his latest collection of poems, The Toy Soldier. As a way of transitioning to another section of your book, I'm going to quote William Carlos Williams. "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." And of course, that's from Asphodel, that greeny flower. In one section of The Toy Soldier, The Causes of War, you have a series of 7 poems, each one referring to a different cause. For instance, indifference, vanity, violence. These aren't the usual anti-war rants that you might expect to find, and I was pleasantly surprised to find that when I read these poems. The poems approach the subject from different angles, and they're just really lovely. Would you read a few of them? Maybe Vanity, Lust, and Greed.
Johnson, thank you. Yes, what I very much wanted to do in the series was to take a rather common vice, a rather well-known, a rather, you could even say, an exaggerated vice, and to present it in its most mundane, ordinary, sort of secret way. Because insofar as things happen ordinarily, we don't suspect them. We don't even understand them as vice or virtue. And I wanted it to be, as it were, almost invisible and to sort of seep through the waves. The water will seep through some cloth, or all of a sudden a stain will appear on the other side of the blotter. And then you can see that that kind of attitude, say this whole notion of vanity, allows the pomposity, the arrogance, and finally this, the terrible invasions. All right, let me read Vanity and see if that works. Vanity. "The ocean is a universe expanding in all directions from this island where I stand on a long point of ledge. Tidewater pools in the crevices. Shiners and crabs swim the pools. Gulls pick the sand. The earth seesaws from edge to edge at this patient hour of peace. The daylight cools. The distant mountains, as blue as classical Tuscan hills, gather the vanishing light. So I remember the green mountains in childhood, when I used to dream of striding from peak to peak, heel to toe, against my father's will, across the top of our yard, down the spine of the broken world."
This is really, this is one of the poems that I wish that our listeners could see. Go get the book, The Toy Soldier. But you have that half line, "The earth seesaws from edge to edge." And that's exactly what the form of this poem is doing. You have half a line far to the left, half a line far to the right. It seesaws continuously through the poem. It's just wonderful.
Well, it's very wonderful that you see that, because that's it's a great reward. It's a great reward to want to do something, to try to do something and have someone catch it and respond. I feel very lucky. This is Crazy Jane is from the, well, first of all, say Willie is W.B. Yeats, and Crazy Jane are the Crazy Jane poems. So this is playing with the images that Yeats made in the Crazy Jane poems, the wild one. The point being, of course, that there's a huge distinction between the passion that drives love and the madness that drives lust.
And the name of this poem is Lust.
Right. Well, it's lust that gets into war. I mean, it's a lesson. Mm-hmm.
We're still talking about the causes of war.
The causes of war. Yes. These three poems are the causes of war. And lust is one of the causes of war. "Each month under the swelling moon, Crazy Jane went wild for Willie, his money, his patrician name, herself the cynosure of fairy. Nothing in life is ever lost. The passionate heart presumes a story. Love springs forward like a broken hand swinging on the porcelain face of a clock. The flag on the moon flaps for each electric phase. Nothing in life is ever lost. The passionate heart demands a story. Night offers no rest. Men ride the solar wind from moon to moon to galloping triumph. Like a dream, the springtide brings in the winner's name. Nothing in life is ever lost. The passionate heart pounds out a story."
And those lines, "nothing in life is ever lost, the passionate heart resumes a story," those are Yeats?
No, that's mine.
Those are yours.
Yeah.
Because they're italicized, I wondered.
So I simply put them there to take them outside, to make it very clear that they're commentary without being a refrain as such, that it's a kind of refrain. And I wanted very much to de-romanticize the poem. I don't know whether that works that way or not, but that was the idea. Even by, because usually if you have a kind of refrain, it becomes sort of a romantic song, it becomes sort of the chorus.
Yes.
And
yes.
I meant it to be an anti-chorus or a hostile mm-hmm. chorus or an annoying chorus in that sense.
I don't know if I was annoyed by them, but yes.
And you see, I mean, I forgot to say also, of course, when I say each electric phase, electricity works in phases.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
people, it comes that way. That's alternating current comes
right,
in phases.
Right. Okay. Yes. Okay, and now we have greed.
It's funny. I don't know how it's a very pleasant time chatting with you. I did have a great aunt named Alice. And great aunt Alice had a music box. That is true. That was there. And the line in their autumn beauty, of course, is Yeats's line. Nobody waits for the fall. I should say autumn, the link to other languages in the family. But that seems antiquated, like Aunt Alice, who wore a choker with a cameo of her mother and every evening played the music box as big as a trunk in the living room by bay window. She knew when the trees were in their autumn beauty, but she had forgot who told her. The world she walked in, house by house on autumn afternoons down an elm-lined street, fell with her family of majestic trees and the nobility of Europe. Alice was a lady, friends and neighbors said, like her mother. The house was sold, the pathways and the box torn up. Solar panels replaced her window. Old men lamented the passing of her beauty, though none had ever loved her. Now, past the Virgin, we have come to autumn again. The street is patrolled by a different family. In the cold nights of despair, we imagine Alice, a saint in blue, as pure as the Holy Mother, impatient to have our sacrifices box after box like Christmas presents. In the window of heaven, the world parades her everlasting beauty and the men who kill to get her. You might also notice that's the one in which, of the three stanzas, the end words are all the same.
Before I move on to the anthology, which I want to do real soon, would you like to choose one of the five poems that you translated from the Russian to read?
The one that's most fun to hear, the Snorters, I think, is one I like most. Also, the Akhmatova is terribly nice. What about the Akhmatova? Can we read that?
Absolutely.
All right. She was really a grande dame. Did you follow? Have you ever followed something of her biography? She was a very, very naughty young woman. She was very naughty. She was absolutely ravishing, terribly bright, very talented, very beautiful, and loved the attentions that she got very deservedly. Right. So it's certainly one young man wiped himself out over frustration for not being her lover. But she married, she had a baby with Kumilyov, and she let her parents bring it up. I mean, she was just having too good a time in the period before the First World War, being in the bohemian world of all the poets and very, very successful. And then her life turned very bitter because Kumilyov was accused, well, he was anti-Soviet, and he was punished for it. And the son himself, much later, was imprisoned because of it. And she felt extremely guilty for that. Mm-hmm. This was her fault. Also in that whole period, first of all in the 30s, but then again in the 40s and 50s, after the Zhdanov period, she hardly had any living. She became an old and very poor person. Hugely admired and had very fine, very dear, very important friends. She also had, I'll just say one more, couple of little quick things. She was very cooperative and very polite to Frost, who was amazingly, amazingly rude to her.
Oh my.
Because, well, he wasn't actually insulting, but he was extremely stupid and indifferent because the competition was clear too much for him. Because they both were up for the Nobel Prize that year.
Oh, no.
Right. And of course, it didn't go to either one of them. It went to Steinbeck. But it was that kind of thing. So that this poem, which she read when Frost and she were together. I had met her the year before and arranged this meeting with Mikhail Alexeyev. The lovely day, lovely time. She was fine. I liked her enormously. I liked Akhmatova a great deal and, of course, admired her work. And again, I tell you, poets are wonderful. We can't tell the truth. She said to Frost that she'd written the poem the day before and she recited it. She hadn't written it the day before. She'd written it about 3 months before.
Oh, details.
Exactly. The hell with the details. It doesn't matter. That's right. That's right. Anyway, there she was and she read it. And this is the poem. Morozova was a 17th century old believer, schismatic. Her stepmother, Dido, and Joan is Joan of Arc. Mm-hmm. It's called The Last Rose. I bend my head when Morozova bows in prayer. I dance with Herod's stepdaughter, Salome. I fly up in the smoke from Dido's fire to be with Joan again at her auto da fe. Oh, Lord. You see, I am too tired to be resurrected more, or made to die, or live. Take everything away, but let me feel anew the freshness of this bright red rose. She lived for that. She really meant that.
Yes,
and that it came across in all her conversations and in her best poetry.
I'm happy to hear you talk about how she led kind of a wild life at one point, too, wow. Because all of the depictions that I've seen in her in film and so on, have shown this bleak life with the loss of the husband, the loss of the son.
She certainly suffered very much under Soviet repression. There's no question about that. But before that, no, she had a wild, wonderful bohemian life. And even in the days when things were very hard and very heavy, she had some very fine and loyal friends. So she was supported. She didn't live in the heart of a happy bourgeois family, but she wouldn't have tolerated that anyway. And she was, in a very, very real sense, because of her intelligence and her strength and because of the literary support and respect that she'd had all her life, she was a grande dame. And there'd be no question, if you're trying to go through the door at the same time, who'd go first?
Yeah. Sorry, Robert Frost.
That's right. You got it. The cat was in New Orleans when Katrina hit, and so we have the Blue Cat Blues. The river rose, done took my house, the devil made off with my jack. Sail or swim like a fish, how'll I ever get it back? No way today to wash the blackness from the sea. No way, no way to take the blueness out of me. The levees broke. No more canal, the gulf has swallowed up town hall. No place safe, no dry land, Satan's won the Powerball. No way today to wash the blackness from the sea. No way, no way to take the blueness out of me. My girl ran off where living's free, FEMA got the best of me. Whites drove out, black swam in, gone, long gone, racial harmony. No way today to wash the blackness from the sea. No way, no way to take the blueness out of me. Lower Ninth was drowned, our town. Lost my parrot and my pup. Jack all gone, no help coming. No one here to bell the levees up. No way today to wash the blackness from the sea. No way, no way to take the blueness out of me.
F.D. Reeve. You are the father of Christopher Reeve. And sitting here looking at you, no one has to tell me that. The resemblance is just remarkable. And people know him as an actor, but he also, he accomplished so much after he stopped being an actor.
He had a wonderfully real life after the accident. It was very hard for him to get to that point. The first 2 years after the accident were extremely difficult psychologically for him. But he did. He transformed himself in a magical way, in a way that makes everybody very happy and pleased and proud to know him.
Absolutely. I mean, he really became a hero for the spinal cord injury.
Absolutely. So, right.
Yeah. Well, before closing, I'd like to ask you to read a couple of more poems. Would you please read City Yard and then the last poem in the book, Home in Wartime?
Yes. On winter mornings, light swirls down among the buildings like scraps of paper speckled with ashes and lost names. Last year's flowers lie in a corner under wet leaves and soft gray snow. Laughter from the summer gardens swings in the ailanthus with the jays. The constant space, the changing light. Brittle limbs coated in birdsong. The harmonium of spring, a world of tact. Fabled nightingale and swallow safe in the night out of range of the hawk. All eyes scan the horizon with passion. Rain runs down the pavement like warm blood. In dreams, the hot, elusive heart dives deeply into the dark ocean, hunting the shapes that move the sea. Overhead, the clouds float past the buildings like islands of old snow. In the air, nothing in sight but the Sunday paper and the shadows of the redeeming green. October. The sun puts up its light, the tree, its leaves, against the winter. The flowers die in their white shells. Attracted by love and believing still in happiness, the mind paints its own immortal garden, each rose an illuminated name. Home in Wartime. Oxbows round the lower pasture wall. New-mown hay and honeysuckle sweeten the bitter modern air. Sunlight waterfalls over the woods. Life is a dream. The phalanx of pin-headed turkeys parading the meadow ignores the war. But the birch leaves shake with fear, and the mountain burns with reprisals. Give me your hand. Trust it like love down the hall at night. If I die first, gather the lost years with the late September apples. At sunset, ghost me beside you on the steps to watch the tangerine lavender clouds turn gray. Go on. Go on. If you die first, the sheets as cold as fish, the dogs whimpering their loneliness each morning, the old walls cracking the silence, I'll lay your ashes on top of the hill where the sky begins.
F.D. Reeve, thank you so much.
Catherine, thank you. It's been delightful just chatting and talking.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Word Temple. My guests tonight included Sonoma County poet Kathleen Winter, reading from her first full-length collection, Nostalgia from the Criminal Past. Following Winter, you heard a portion of an interview I recorded with poet and writer F.D. Reeve, including a cut from his CD, The Blue Cat Walks the Earth. Be sure to check out wordtemple.com to view the schedule for the live Word Temple Poetry Series in Sebastopol. Right now, we have events lined up through October. That's wordtemple.com. And one other announcement, the Sonoma County Book Festival will take place on September 22nd in Courthouse Square, Santa Rosa, and various locations. You can check this year's offerings by going to socobookfest.org. That's socobookfest.org. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.